We're glad tonight to have Dale Holloway, the consultant for the Bivocational Ministries, the consultant for Bivocational Ministries in the Rural Urban Department of the Home Mission Board, as our keynote speaker. I know he's been through Missouri, so he's all right. He went to Midwestern Seminary, so that helps some. But we're delighted to have him with us. We had an opportunity today at noon to meet with Brother Holloway as we looked at the possibilities of doing some things here at Southern Seminary with regard to bivocational ministries. We're very interested in this area and in this calling, and we want to do some things in that direction. We're pleased that he's willing to help us in that and willing also to help us in this conference as he not only speaks for us tonight but also leads workshops. Brother Dale, come and lead us in our thinking tonight as we look together at strengthening the small church.
Friends, teachers, and classmates, our little boat stands at rest tonight at the bend of the stream, and we're pausing a while to draw in our breath for the work ahead. The voyage of life passes through many deep and unknown channels with windings and turnings that often make it hard for us to tell what... Oh, me, that's the wrong speech. That was my 8th grade valedictorian address. I did that so that you'd know that I was a valedictorian of my 8th grade class. But when I got in high school, I wasn't a valedictorian, and I wasn't a salutatorian, and I just did get in the auditorium. I like to see who's here. A man thought he had them all sized up. He said, let's see how many Baptists are here tonight. Everybody raised their hand, except one little lady. He said, lady, stand up and tell this group what you are. She said, well, I'm a Methodist. He said, now, tell the group why you're a Methodist. She said, well, my mother's Methodist, my daddy's Methodist, my grandmother's Methodist. I suppose all our family have been Methodists. He said, now, let's just suppose all your family had been idiots. What would that have made you? She said, oh, I see what you mean. I guess I'd have been a Baptist, too. This woman was trying to impress on visiting evangelist about how much visiting she was doing during revival. She said, Brother Green, yesterday I went way on the other side of the mountain to ask this woman to come to revival. You won't believe how dumb that woman was. She was so ignorant she didn't even know who Lottie Moon was. She hadn't ever heard of Annie Armstrong. And I shook my finger in her face and I said, woman, read your Bible. You know, it's going to be cold in the morning. It got so cold last week in Jackson, someone saw a lawyer with his hands in his own pocket. This lady called the fire department, and she said, help, help, I got a fire. He said, where is it, lady? She said, it's in the kitchen. He said, well, how do I get there? She said, you can come through the living room, but it's best to come up on the back porch. He said, but how do I get from where I am to where you are? She says, ain't y'all still got that big old red truck? Sometimes communication is difficult. This zealous witness was talking to an Appalachian man. He said, are you lost? And the Appalachian man said, no, son, I've been on this hill 40 years. He said, but have you found Jesus? He said, I didn't know he was lost. He said, but are you a member of the Christian band? He said, no, but I play a mean fiddle. He said, but you don't understand. Are you ready for the judgment? He said, when is it? He said, well, it may be tomorrow, and it may be next week. He said, son, when you find out for sure, will you let me know? I think my old lady will want to go both days. I want us to talk about bivocational ministry in the small church. I'm overwhelmed following Gary Fairley. I'm intimidated and overshadowed. According to my weight chart, I'm supposed to be 6'3". I've been stretching. I don't know a great deal about a small church. I do know a lot about bivocational ministry. So I decided to talk to you about something I know about. We are a convention of small churches. We have always been a convention of small churches. Until 1918, three-fourths of all Southern Baptist churches were fourth time. Some of you can remember being pastor of more than one church, perhaps. You held down four churches at one time. You literally did hold down four churches. Until 1948, there were more half-time churches than full-time churches. And today, the median church has 236 resident members and 116 enrolled in Sunday school, and average attendance is 63. Now, what I've just said, half of all our churches next Sunday will have less than 64. 18,000 churches with less than 64 in Sunday school. Now, bivocational ministry is not new. We have now 10,000 bivocational pastors, Southern Baptist churches. One of every four ministers is bivocational. And if we recognize the fact that most of us bivocational pastors are pastors of small churches, then bivocational ministry has a great significance when we study small churches. Bivocational ministry is not new. Bivocational ministry is older than the carpenter's bench in Nazareth. We can go way back into antiquity. Abraham was a cattle raiser, and Hagar was a domestic worker, and Isaac was a farmer, and Rebekah was a water carrier, and Jacob was a roving rancher, and Rachel was a sheep herder, and Joseph was a premier, and Miriam was a babysitter, and Moses was a flock raiser, and Joshua was a military commander, and Rahab was an innkeeper, among other things. And Deborah was a national deliverer. Gideon was a military leader. Samson was a champion fighter. Ruth was a gleaner. Boaz was a grain grower. David was a ruler. Asaph was a composer. Solomon was an emperor. The Queen of Sheba was an administrator. Job was a gentleman farmer. Amos was a bivocational sharecropper. Baruch was a writer. Daniel was a prime minister. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were provincial administrators. In the New Testament, our Lord's stepfather Joseph was a carpenter. Martha was a housekeeper. Zacchaeus was a tax collector. Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea were Supreme Court counselors. Barnabas was a landowner. Cornelius was an officer. Luke was a doctor. Priscilla, Aquila, and Paul were tent makers. Our most illustrious forerunner said this: I have not coveted anyone's silver, gold, or clothing. You yourselves know that these hands of mine have supplied my own needs and the needs of my companions. In everything I did, I showed you that by this kind of hard work, we must help the weak, remembering the words the Lord Himself said, it's more blessed to give than to receive. We come on down into history not so ancient, and we learn that all Anabaptists were bivocational. The most illustrious one, John Bunyan, those 12 years he spent in Bedford jail, he supported his family by making lace sold by his blind daughter. We come down to modern missions, and the father of modern missions went to India to reach the lost, but he supported himself as administrator or the superintendent of an indigo factory in Calcutta. We note that nearly every Baptist preacher on the frontier was bivocational. At the close of the Civil War, there were only 5 fully supported ministers in the whole state of Texas. We learn that some of our institutions have their foundation in bivocational ministry. On the Hardin-Simmons campus, there's a historical marker that said this university started as Abilene Baptist College was started by a group of cattlemen preachers. In this state, in the center of Georgetown, there's a historical marker that reads, Georgetown was founded by Elijah Crowley. Georgetown was founded by Elijah Craig, a Baptist minister, who also is credited with the formula for Kentucky bourbon whiskey. The ravens could bring him food, but he had his own drink. Today, I really didn't mean to speak despairingly about Elijah Craig. Some of you know what a great Baptist leader he was, and I don't mean to discredit him. Some of you know his history well. Bivocational ministry today is a viable ministry. This may be a surprise to you. When we study the churches that are pastored by bivocational pastors, we learn that they have a higher baptism ratio. They have a higher Sunday school enrollment per 100. They have a higher Sunday school average attendance.
They have a higher training union enrollment. They are successful in more new church starts than similar churches pastored by full-time pastors. We know that they're scattered in different concentrations. The greatest concentration of bivocational ministers is in the South. A 500-mile radius of my home, Jackson, Mississippi, in a 500-mile radius, there are 7,700 bivocational pastors. The state that wins the banner is Alabama. They have a little more than 51% of all the pastors in the state are bivocational. The smallest number is in Hawaii. They just have one. Roy's son-in-law is a state director of missions there, and I'm thinking about going on a bivocational ministry hunt with my wife at least once a year. We do know that the great need for bivocational ministers are in new work areas of our convention. I don't think the present distribution of ministry persons is according to God's plan. I want to make a statement. I think the biggest challenge the Southern Baptist Convention faces today is to match every ministry person to the ministry opportunity that God has planned for them. It just doesn't seem fair for us to be all stacked up, so tightly packed with so much feverish activity going on under the same bushel that we are liable to set the bushel afire when there are so many lonely places that are in such desperate need of ministry leadership. We sometimes think we have too many preachers. I read a study that was surprising. In 1950, all major Protestant denominations had more churches than they had ministers. The Southern Baptist ratio at that time was 0.8 ministers per Southern Baptist church. But in the year 1977, this had changed. In every major denomination, there are more ministers than there are churches, with the exception of the United Methodists. The ones having the most extreme problem are the Episcopalian. They've projected that if the trend continues until 2005, there will be one Episcopal priest for each Episcopal member. We have today almost two ministers for each church. I thought about that before speaking in the seminary at Southwestern and wondered if I would dare be that give such a discouraging word. But then I thought of something that was exciting. God has called out 37,000 more ministers than we have churches. And they're in some phase of their training or preparation. And that means that already in God's mind, there are 37,000 new ministry opportunities, and it's up to us to discover them and to plan for them and to strategize and plant new congregations. I remember something Quinn Pugh said to us in Ridgecrest. He said in our association at that time, he was director of missions in Manhattan, Northern New Jersey, the most populous association in the nation. He said, in our association, we have more lost millions than the total population of 61 foreign countries that we send missionaries to. And we are in desperate need of leadership, and we have no hope of establishing new congregations or strengthening congregations we have without a great infusion of bivocational ministers. It's not a question about whether bivocational ministry is superior. It's not a question of which is ordained of God or which is the best strategy or plan. It's simply which one can be used to plant new churches. I did a little figuring. I thought about these 18,000 new churches we're trying to start before the end of the century. I've been a bivocational pastor for 33 years, and I've been a church planter in four different locations. And I know what it takes to gather a congregation, and I know what it costs for 5 acres of ground, and I know what it costs to build the first unit and what it costs to support a pastor's family. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $250,000 to $300,000 to get a church built and established and equipped. Well, it figures $4.3 billion That's more than all the cooperative program dollars for 20 years. You know, if we think we're going to start all these congregations with a full-time seminary graduate, fully supported, then we're not very realistic. Bivocational ministry is a mission strategy of responding to circumstances as they are, of doing whatever it takes to work out the ministry God has called us to. I want us to think about what you can do as directors of missions, what you can do as leaders in your association, what you can do and the place you are to assist in complementing the lives and ministries of bivocational ministers. The first thing you can do is provide encouragement and affirmation. Now, that looks like a very common, ordinary thing to say. What you want to do, just give 10,000 men a warm, fuzzy feeling about themselves. Why is this important? I remember for 21 years, I labored under the illusion that I was a failure. I got up on Monday morning and drove to work like the rest of my congregation. And this feeling of failure was intensified somewhat by what I heard. Some of you have an obnoxious brother-in-law. An obnoxious brother-in-law would say something like, "I wonder when Dale's ever going to be a real preacher." And those I worked with in education before becoming your national consultant for bivocational ministry, I was supervisor of elementary education for the state of Mississippi, responsible for accrediting the elementary schools. And when we visited the schools, I'd hear them talking in committee meetings, and I'd hear them whisper, and someone would say something like, "You know, Holloway's some kind of a preacher." They didn't really understand that education simply was my enabler, my vehicle to perform the vocation that God had called me to. But those I worked with full-time, those are the ones that hurt me the most, because they would say it plainly and rudely and crudely, "Dale, if you're going to work in education, why don't you get out of the ministry? Or, if you're going to preach, why don't you turn education loose? Where's your faith? If you're going to walk on the water, you've got to get out of the boat." And that sounded right, and I felt wrong, until something wonderful happened 10 years ago last month. The first article, to my knowledge, in any Southern Baptist literature, appeared in the Home Mission Magazine, October 1977, and it was a story about bivocational ministers. And there they were, cutting down trees in the Northwest, and counselors in Ohio, and postmasters in Alabama, and catfish farmers in Mississippi. And they said, "It's all right to work and preach. Where would we be as a convention without you? From Paul to today, bivocational pastors have filled church history. They're the worker priest. The non-stipendary clergy are a word that we've coined. It's a Southern Baptist word. It's not in the dictionary yet. Bivocational. He works with his hands. He supports himself and his family. He crams in extra Bible study and sermon preparation. He's always in conflict in his dilemma with time, but he's usually successful in both vocations." After reading that, I was surprised that the convention understood me, appreciated me. I experienced such a life lift that I hadn't experienced since I was saved as a junior boy. For the first time, I recognized I am legitimate. My Father's God. And my call is just as real as the call of R.G. Lee or anyone else's call. My ministry is different because that's the ministry God planned for me, and I'm living and growing and blooming in the place God has planted me. I think that's the first thing we owe these persons is encouragement and affirmation, and you can do that in many different ways. I think we owe them also an understanding of who they are and the struggles they go through and the frustrations they face. When they first tried to amplify our ministry, they really didn't understand who bivocational ministers were. They had a poor opinion of who we were. They thought we were uncouth and uneducated and poor and ignorant and uncultured, and what they need is some seminars around so they can lift us up some. They thought we all worked 40 acres with a mule. Well, that's an old picture. And it's true that some of us don't have a lot of culture. I grew up in a little place in South Mississippi called Sanitary Landfill. No, our town was Carrier in Pearl River County. But if you grow up in Carrier, you have to learn culture after you leave home. A boy went walking with his mother, and he said, "Hey, Mama, look at that big old bow-legged cowboy." She said, "Goodness, you embarrassed me, talking like a street urchin. You'll have to go to your room and study Shakespeare for 30 days. You'll learn how to talk in public." So he pored over Shakespeare For 30 days we went walking, met the same big bow-legged man, but he knew better and said, "Hey, Ma, look at that big old bow-legged cowboy." He'd been studying Shakespeare for 30 days. He was cultured. And it came out like this: "Behold, Marm, what manner of men are these who walk with their legs in parentheses?" After a lot of listening conferences that were scheduled and conducted by my predecessor, very able foundation builder, Dr. J.T. Burdine, they began to put together some of the fragments of our picture, and they began to understand us better. You know, it's dangerous to be presumptive. Some of you are presumptive. You figure you know everything about a person by the way they dress or the first sentence they speak. A man walked in a drugstore, and he said, "Have you got anything with the hiccups?" And the druggist reached under the counter and pulled out a hammer and hit him right between the eyes. He said, "I said, have you got anything for the hiccups?" And he said, "Aha, you don't have the hiccups anymore, do you?" He said, "I never did have the hiccups. It's from my wife in the car." Sometimes they think they have our prescription, but it doesn't fit what ails us. I think we owe bivocational ministers encouragement, affirmation. I think we owe them understanding. And then another thing I think we owe them, I think we owe them equipping, preparing, training. The best church planter is not the fresh seminary graduate. He's the one most willing to go to Dayton to start a church. He has to move out of seminary housing June 13th. And so he goes to a place where you're serving in Indiana or Illinois or some other place where it's very difficult, and he don't know what it's like. You know, he can't imagine it being like that. And his wife is going through a culture shock, and she's so homesick he has to keep the door locked every night to keep her from moving back to Birmingham. And he's learning how to pastor, and he's learning how to preach and relate to people and gather a group of believers, and it's too much. In 6 months, he leaves. What do they think about commitment? What do they think about Southern Baptists? The best church starters are men and women your age and mine, but we're also the most reluctant to go. We're like the tree planted by the river of water. We shall not be moved. We have a number of men in Boys Bible School and Clear Creek School, and we have a lot of seminary students that came to the seminary late in life. God had already given them a skill. They're gifted. They can command a good salary. They already have a very good, marketable, portable skill. And I'm saying somehow we have to challenge these persons to recognize the only way to minister is not to be a fully supported minister in a big church. We have to recognize who we are, where our churches are, the size of our churches, the need for new church starters, the need for staff members in struggling churches. And so we could revolutionize missions tomorrow if we could have a national strategy of strengthening every church in the convention with a multi-staff of bivocational staff people. So we somehow, we need to sensitize and train and equip these persons. Students in the seminary need to learn that it's wise to choose and nurture a second vocation as an enabler. They need to come out with not only an MDiv, but perhaps an MBA, or they need to be qualified to be a school principal or an elementary teacher. Why not? Why not be a professional person? What's so wonderful about having work in the Pizza Hut while you're starting a church in Massachusetts? I'm saying that we need a strategy, a plan, assistance, information, orientation that says even back as a freshman in college, you'd be wise to choose and nurture a second vocation as a means of ministry. It won't hurt you if you never need it, fine. So this is one of the things we're trying to do, is establish fellowships on all the campuses. Just today, just 5 or 6 hours ago, a little longer than that now, we planted the seeds that I trust will result in an intentional bivocational ministry fellowship, Southern Seminary. They would meet monthly, and they would network together. May result with three couples going together to start a church, with each being a special staff person. They're all kind of explosive potential and possibilities. I know that another curse in our convention is short tenure. This is one of the curses of small church pastorate. The kingdom of God never has been built in dashes and flashes. What do they do at weddings more than anything? They take pictures. They'll finally get a videotape and dispense with us preachers altogether. I've got to where I prefer funerals over weddings. They're more permanent. Candles are not very flashy, but candles are very effective, pushing back the darkness as long as they shine. I say to you, we have too many dash men in our convention. Anyone can run 50 yards in a sack. What we need are mile runners. What we need are men committed to do whatever it takes, to be there when the seed is planted and nurtured, and be there through the long, hard work of the growing, and then to not leave before they can come rejoicing, bringing in the sheaves. I say to you, we need stability in ministry. And bivocational ministry can allow a person to stay the full length of time. It provides the church security and stability. It provides security and stability for that pastor's family that they so desperately need. And so I see bivocational ministry, if I was talking about the strengths of bivocational ministry, I would say it provides security and stability. It provides means of support while a person is planting a new church. And it provides the kind of leader that some of our small churches deserve. I fully agree, Dr. White, with what you say. It's the same thing I say as I close almost every time. The Lord has called many servants. No, I'll change that. The Lord has called few servants to be successful. God has called us all to be faithful.
If you are a bivocational minister tonight, I hope that you feel the blessing that we have intended to provide for you in this conference. We want you to be blessed. If you are a colleague, if you are a fellow minister of bivocational ministers back where you are, you have been invited to take this blessing to them and share it with them and give them validation for the ministry to which God has called them. It's been good to be together tonight. You don't need to rush off. You can take a few moments to visit and talk with each other, a few moments for fellowship. We've planned some time for that. But let's stand for word of benediction. I'm going to ask my friend Hayward Calvert to lead us in our benediction and then take a few minutes to visit and get acquainted. May we pray.